Greetings and welcome to Opportunities in Emerging and Global Markets. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. And as a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, June 4th, 2020. I'd now like to turn it over to Mr. Barry Mandinack, Executive Vice President and Head of Distribution. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Barry Mandinack, and I am EVP and Head of Distribution at Virtus Investment Partners. I'm pleased to be joined by Matt Benkendorf. Matt's the Chief Investment Officer of Vontobel Asset Management and the Lead Portfolio Manager of the Virtus Vontobel Emerging Markets Opportunities Fund. Today we're going to discuss the current landscape in emerging and global markets, including recent market volatility, where we see opportunities, as well as the long-term value of a quality approach. I want to welcome everybody and thank you for joining us today. I'll start it off with a few questions, get Matt rolling, and then we're going to open it up to the field right after that. So Matt, 2020 has been quite a ride for investors. We've seen the recent low set in March 23rd. And EM has shown signs of recovery, returning, I think, just over 20% since the market low in March. From your perspective, how has the landscape changed over the course of these last few months?
Thanks, Barry. Thank you, everyone. Yeah, just jumping right into it, I think two basic big pieces that are probably quite obvious. I think the first is the most powerful one, and that's psychology. Psychology has changed materially over the last couple of months. And that's the one where, you know, if you could dig deep and hold on to your pants in March and not get shaken out, there was tremendous opportunity there, which we think we took advantage of. But it was a short window. It was a quick window of real despair, as long as it felt during that period. And clearly now to where we are today, we're on the other side of that ravine. And then also fundamentals then, right? So it was psychology, I'd say, was the most overpowering one. Fundamentals did obviously change sharply from what was rather robust and strong here in the U.S. fundamentals to quick deterioration. Emerging markets, things were, you know, starting to improve and get better and then weaken again. But once again, fundamentals also are switching back quickly. So we're now back on the upswing. So that's the good news. You know, fundamentals went from good to really bad to improving again. And psychology went from really euphoric to really, really pessimistic to optimistic again. So I know we're in a 30-second news cycle world, but we've seen once again that just patience and discipline are really our most powerful investment advantages to do well in the long term. And we have been able to take advantage of that in March.
So Matt, from your perspective, I know a lot of people, when you think of active management, you think risk mitigation. I hire an active manager for risk mitigation. What risks are you monitoring today in the aftermath of this pretty substantial advance since the March lows?
Yeah, I think for our quality growth companies, I think we're well past the extreme sort of tail risk management solvency issues that we had to make sure we were triple checking back in March. That really quickly went from, you know, our normal standard risk processes to a real dig deep triple check, make sure even the highest quality of companies, which could have an air gap of earnings and even revenue, could bridge that. We're past that. But I think what also sounds maybe a little bit counterintuitive right now is when you ask about risk, you know, realistically, the portfolios had a lot less risk today than they did, funny enough. You know, for quality companies, we always talk about this, when markets and prices go down for quality companies, something fundamental happens, is you actually get lower risk in the names via valuation. So when you're paying 60% of fair value versus 80% of fair value for great businesses, you're always lowering your risk. And the emerging markets portfolio in particular today, you know, given what we were able to do and coming through March and where we still sit today depressed in terms of valuations, but on its way back already, is a much lower risk portfolio. So we're through the abnormalities of the COVID crisis, I'd say, in terms of looking at risk. We have a portfolio with lower embedded risk in it as it stands today, and we're always relatively lower than the benchmark, but the valuation depression is giving us extra buffer there. And now, you know, we're back to the day-to-day blocking and tackling in terms of risk. You know, the obvious stuff you're reading about, the monitoring of situations in the emerging markets themselves, whether it's Brazil, India, et cetera.
So I've heard other portfolio managers talk about this kind of shift, that the rising tide that lifted all boats for much of the last decade seems to have receded, and that the need for skill and judgment seems to be higher in a post-COVID world, if you will. Could you touch on that?
Look, I think there's a couple things there. You know, we always have to make the case for active. I think there's another interesting dynamic going on within active management right now. You know, and this is the glass full, half full, glass half empty scenario for us in particular. If you look at what's done really well this year so far, even within active, it's been a very narrow market. And now, look, we have some names that have done well that are owned in a narrower market, but those that have really, really done well this year, even within active, are in a really narrow band of names in a very concentrated way. And it's almost becoming a little bit quasi-index-like because it's a lot of momentum and a lot of cash flow continuing to follow and fuel a very narrow portion of the market up. And that holds in emerging markets, it holds in the developed markets. So I think it's particularly important, one, still to be active, obviously, but you know, when you're active, and even if you're in quality, as a lot of people call themselves quality, I still feel really good that we look different still. And I think the way we look different and look different within quality, even though, yes, it's been a drag so far in our underlying results, but it's quickly improving. And you're showing now, you know, we have a lot of quality. And within our quality, actually, as I alluded to in the first question, we have a good degree of undervaluation. So we have a bit of value. And that's why, you know, if you look over the past week, we've been particularly strong because we're getting a lot of payback now for the patients we've had.
Yeah. So the last time we spoke, you talked about taking advantage of recent market volatility and using it to incrementally upgrade your portfolios. Can you share some insights in terms of select changes that you've made?
Yeah, I think we've made basically, I'd say, four types of moves, broadly speaking. One, obviously, is where COVID set in and there could be a negative permanent impact, i.e. thesis-changing sell. And I'm happy to say, you know, although we didn't have a crystal ball across all of our portfolios and with none in the EM we had to react to, we had one name in that bucket, for example, in Globals, Royal Caribbean Cruises, that we sold very early and very quickly on back in March. We were already trimming it in Jan-Feb and then finished it in March quickly. And that's the name where we were willing to hold the name through a recession, but given the unique nature of COVID and how we were uncertain how that industry itself could evolve, even being consolidated as it was, we had to react and sell and cut risk there for our investors. And I'm not exaggerating, that's one name really, and none in emerging we had to react that way. Second, you know, we had short-term impactful moves where we could buy and optimize the portfolio where businesses were going to be impacted short-term, even high quality ones in their earnings stream. And we could buy and increase our holdings because the near-term earnings were way down and the market's a voting machine and it was voting against them early. And that buckets, you know, a number of our staples names, which was abnormal this cycle, also depressing our near-term performance, which is already starting to come back now. But staples, obviously, with the off-trade being shut down, were hurt. Names in the discretionary space were beaten down, whether in retailing, et cetera. So that's the second move as we jumped quickly. You know, even sell some of our winners or names that were holding up early to buy into those names that were beaten down quickly because we thought the window wouldn't be too long. The third bucket is names where there could be a positive impact coming out of this, or at least their real long-term fundamentals were strong or could on the margin improve even further because of what was going on. And that's probably intuitively, like you'd think, a number of names in the tech space, a handful of them, not the common big ones that everybody's holding, but there were a few, particularly in the component supplier space in Asia, that got whacked a bit. Some in the communication services business that got hurt. We were able to get into some of them. And that's sort of upgrading, improving the overall quality of the portfolio for the longer term, better growth, better stability, higher growth rates, better quality. And then the last one I'd say that types of moves were in this fourth bucket, which was a real pure valuation opportunity where something we always wanted went on sale. Finally, we had wanted it for years, and that was really in the global portfolio a little bit more. You saw that. These are sort of those really, really high-quality names you want to put in your curio cabinet, like your heirlooms, and set aside and let them just sit there and compound for years. And in global, there were some in the luxury goods space, a rare one in the healthcare space, the tech space, even in industrials, where there are these names that we held in our regional portfolios, but they had never pulled back enough to get their shot into global. And that was sort of the fourth action we took in the downturn.
Well, that's great. Now, just for perspective, I know Adidas is a company that you have, and many people would say, why would a German-based company be in an emerging market fund? Can you touch on that one?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Look, I think that was a real opportunistic investment for us for emerging. I'd say you look at our emerging portfolio, this is the value of our global team. We own in our emerging markets portfolio and have for many years a few multinational companies in there. To give you some color, they're mainly in either the alcoholic beverages space or something like Unilever. And the reason we own them there is, A, obviously because the predominance of their earnings, the majority of their earnings come from the emerging markets, and the majority of their incremental growth on top of that comes from their emerging markets. And in particular for our investors, because we know these businesses so well and own them elsewhere, often in a different regional portfolio, when we look at those examples and you take Unilever as one, we could own it, the multinational multinational, which we do at 17 times earnings, or we could own the local listed subsidiaries in India at 50 times earnings, roughly where it is now, or in Indonesia at around, I think, 40-odd times earnings now. So the multinational is just a much better opportunity for our emerging markets investors and our funds. So that's why we own a multinational like that. If you look at Adidas, it's in that bucket as well. We own it in our regional portfolios. We know it very, very well. The majority of its earnings come from the emerging markets, which might surprise people, particularly 22% alone of revenues, I believe, come from China itself. It got whacked very quickly early because of the downturn in China, because they had been getting a lot of incremental growth from China. But we were able to look through that and take advantage of it, knowing it well for our emerging markets investors. So we think it's consistent. It's a very rare name like that. As I said, there's only a couple of these multinationals. And I think fortunately for our investors in emerging markets, that name itself, I think from where we bought it very quickly in March, is up over 40% already. So that's the benefit of being a global team.
Okay, great. Now, my last question before we open it up to the field. Many people are questioning the validity to addressing home bias with the outperformance of U.S. equities over the past decade. From your perspective, why should an investor still consider diversifying outside the U.S. with emerging or foreign or global portfolios?
Yeah, look, this is, you know, they say there's no such thing as a free lunch in life or investing, but honestly, I think there is a bit of a free lunch here, particularly now in emerging and outside of the U.S. The story is always still simple and clear, just to rehash it. Middle class is where consumption grows more heavily, and the growing middle class is in the emerging markets. So when you look at the emerging markets, particularly now, as I said, the free lunch, that's where there's faster growth, there's much greater undervaluation, and even you get a bit of a diversifying FX potential tailwind to come, or at least an FX diversifier. So for emerging markets, look, the long-term future is very clear. That's why over 20-year horizon, for example, emerging markets has still outperformed the S&P even after 10 tough years of underperformance. So the long-term future is always clear. We know there's shorter-term volatility, but there's greater investment return to be had there. And also, you know, not to be glossed over, I think we talked about this in previous calls. If you really want to own great businesses, which we do, and we want to find them no matter where we can, sometimes you have to go to the emerging markets to find some of these great businesses. They're not all in the developed markets. They're not all in the U.S. These great high-quality businesses with great underlying economics, with great underlying growth, and even in places like tech, right, where people tend to think the U.S. has a monopoly on great tech companies, it might surprise people that, you know, in the emerging markets, you kind of have to go there to get to a great number of these great businesses that'll get you to your investing goals. For example, there's, you know, people who know the music streaming space. There's a much better name in China in the music streaming space with great growth, great profitability, great returns than a name like Spotify even here in the U.S., which most people know rather ubiquitously. So yeah. The story's still very clear in emerging markets. The opportunity outside the U.S. is still very clear. Obviously, we've had a big headwind on currency, particularly against the emerging markets in the last 5 years. Let's keep in perspective with that, though. Even despite the headwind over the last 5 years, the last 20 years, emerging markets have still outperformed the U.S. If we look at our own funds returns in emerging markets over the last 10 years, we've probably lost roughly half of our return to currency, right? That will normalize and come back. So as I said, it's hard to find a free lunch often. But, you know, looking at right now what you get in developed, what you get in emerging or ex-U.S., you know, there are a few really nice areas when you step back and look at the opportunity. And money always finds opportunity. It's a very democratic process, and eventually it's going to find it and get it right.
Okay, great. Thank you, Matt. With that, operator, I'd like to open it up for questions, please. I'll tee one up while we're waiting. We talked about COVID-19 earlier. What do you see as the long-term potential impacts of COVID-19 on the emerging versus developed markets?
I think there's obviously the yin and the yang, the good and the bad here. One, I think for emerging markets investors, and I think where we have also still, you know, a particularly compelling proposition with not only our style but our fund positioning, that maybe people haven't seen benefit them yet, but they will, trust me, with a bit of patience, is, you know, the emerging markets index is 40% in China. If you did well in the emerging markets as an active manager, you're most likely heavy in China or overweight China. And in one area of China, particularly Chinese banks have done particularly well. So when you talk about COVID, the effect on emerging markets, it couples back to this ongoing battle we've had with trade, with realignment of supply chains, potentially risk management within corporations, all these issues. I think it's not negative on emerging markets necessarily, because I think you'll see great benefits to emerging markets ex-China, particularly in the Asian region, even though we can have great tension between the U.S. and China, which might weigh on some of that Chinese exposure. It will more likely be transferred outside of China into the other emerging markets, so I think that's still net good for emerging markets, but where the benefits have been in emerging markets might shift around a little bit. I think, you know, the other thing is when you think about what's been done to try to combat COVID and monetary, from a monetary policy perspective, I hate to bring it up again because it's this one everybody always brings up that still for years hasn't rung true. But if you look at some of these other reconfigurations of supply chains, headwind issues there, potential changes in maybe governments here and effects on taxation, things like that, you might finally get some inflation because you could finally may have structural plus monetary pressures. And there what matters or will matter quite clearly and simply is better business models with pricing power too. So I think it's all still good for quality.
Okay, good. Operator, any other questions?
No questions so far.
All right, I'm going to hit another couple, and then if we wrap it up, we wrap it up. But, you know, everybody's talking about the new world of work from home, and it affects different companies differently, software, e-commerce, and such. Do you see the work from home dynamic being a strong consideration in the companies that you're evaluating? And if so, how?
Yeah, you know, I think if anything, honestly, on the margin, we're a beneficiary of the fear of big change here. That's where we've been capitalizing on things more. So it has a big effect, and I think it has had a big effect psychologically. I think it's way too early for people to draw a lot of the conclusions they have been drawing in terms of permanence of the issues. And I think particularly now, as you sit here in May and you watch, depending on where callers out there are sitting, what sort of normalization is already going on at this point, given where we came from already not that long ago. So, you know, what we're observing is we've done a lot of homework on areas that have been near-term disrupted, making sure that there aren't more permanent changes because of either work from home or the way people consume or where they consume things. That's really near and dear to our heart. We think more habits, you know, die harder than people think. We have a gregarious culture. I think what we've noticed as well, though, very simplistically, while most every one of us probably on this call is fortunate to be able to work remotely, roughly 60% of the U.S. economy can't work remotely in what they do. And out there are a lot of businesses and a lot of opportunities. And it's very similar for emerging markets. It's even more disproportionately weighted that way. So while it might make a lot of common sense to do so, where and if you can, sure, that has probably already happened. It might happen some more, but you know, there's a great proportion of economic activity still that I think will more or less revert back to normal. And that's where we've been really active, making sure we are quick to take advantage of it. And then also patient, you know, and not reactive in capitulating. You know, and look, it's very clear one drag on our portfolio so far that's starting to normalize even in the last week much more quickly too has been staples, which normally outperforms in a downturn. But when you own staples and own alcoholic beverages, it doesn't do so well when you shut down the bars and restaurants. But that's very myopic in near term, you know, to worry about that. Yep.
One more question for me anyway. China,
yeah.
It dominates the headlines. It dominates the MSCI EM index. And it dominates a lot of the EM managers who had some of the best performance in the last year or two. Can you touch on your thoughts about that and the implications on a go-forward basis?
Yeah, look, we are roughly today 15 percentage points underweight China. We have weighting in Hong Kong, though, which can and cannot be, depending on the name, China-exposed businesses. Then we have Taiwan, which isn't, well, it's a big debate what that is or not. So we have exposure in the region, but we're materially underweight China, clearly. It's been a headwind for us. Now, look, there are a number of good Chinese businesses, and we have 20% of our team that speaks Chinese, and we do a lot of work on Chinese businesses. So, look, I have opinions on these things. We all do, and we all read the news, and there's lots of things happening geopolitically, but we're looking for great businesses, and the great businesses, we define them, need to be robust and resilient and be able to get through both political and economic turmoil. So, but China has great domestic private sector businesses. They require a lot of work, but there are a lot of hurdles to getting into them. Corporate governance issues, you know, history of founders of those businesses. And we got a great effort into them, and we own, we think, a great handful of them right now already. You know, I think marginally over time, a lot of them screen well. We'll pick up more of them. But the ones now that are doing a bit better, you know, particularly one area that also hurt us a bit on a relative basis were Chinese financials and banks. You know, nothing's going to change here for us to the positive, names like those. So, look, China is becoming difficult, I think, as I mentioned a little earlier to your question, Barry, both from an index perspective and the risk you take owning a lot of China, and also now in the active management space, depending on your manager, and owning a lot of China. So I think we touched on a little bit earlier, but just to highlight it, because I think it is actually a little bit underappreciated yet. The Chinese exposure people get I think it's fine, as I said, from a bottom-up perspective if you got great businesses. I'm telling you from experience and from a lot of boots in the ground and effort looking at Chinese businesses, they're hard to get at, though, even though a lot of them look shiny on the surface, but you can make progress there. But a number of the businesses most likely that are owned today have a lot more risk than people appreciate, particularly in light of your other question where some of the dynamics are rapidly changing globally.
Yeah, thank you. Operator, are there any other questions?
We do have a few now. The first one's from Matt McLaughlin. Please go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit about what your views are in Europe and some of the structural kind of and social hurdles you have for those companies over there trying to do business and reward shareholders, and how do you navigate that?
Yeah, well, great question. Look, I appreciate a question about Europe too. A lot of people forget Europe's out there, and we, as you know, or maybe not, we manage a 5-star fund for Europe too. So, look, we obviously find good opportunity there in Europe. I think Europe is a lot, honestly, as the story for the U.S. in terms of fundamental stock picking, right? You know, a lot of people don't look at the U.S. as much top down. They look at the U.S. as a place where there's a lot of great businesses, either domestically focused or globally oriented, particularly in the tech space. And Europe is not that dissimilar that way. Quality in Europe comes in a few different areas than the U.S. traditionally, and it actually comes a little bit more in the staple space. For example, they just happen to be more multinational, global, and more EM-focused given the long histories there. And actually then the industrial space, I would throw that in there too. Europe uniquely has a large number of high-quality industrial companies, and they're high-quality as we call it high quality because a lot of them aren't that cyclical. They're in very durable, predictable businesses. They could be in business process outsourcing, and that's called industrials there. It could be in testing and inspection. It's called industrials there. It could be in academic journals. It's called industrials there. So Europe's ripe like the U.S. is for a lot of great businesses. Those businesses, the more difficult area, I guess, relative to the U.S., where you got to be careful and where we have a valuation discipline, and we do well even with that discipline, is valuation. You know, in Europe, because the European market has a lot of domestic capital there, and they've got a lot of lower quality cyclical businesses, and they've got a lot of top-down issues affecting large swaths like banks, more money gets squeezed into quality there, so you got to be even a little bit more careful of a quality squeeze and selective around valuation. But I'd say, broadly speaking, it's just like the U.S. It's a real ripe stock-picking market. I think overall, as a continent, I think there's actually some both, you always use the analogy, glass half full, glass half empty there. I think the good news is for Europe, you know, they're finally sort of rallying to the ramparts there with fiscal stimulus. You know, they've been reticent, reluctant, whatever you want to call it, for years. Finally, Germany's got its head in the game, which is a big turning point for Europe. So I think the good news for Europe, they've done everything they can monetarily to the point of negative rates. Finally, they're going to get into battle with fiscal issues. I think they still have meaningful structural issues from a top-down perspective, though, to deal with longer term to sort of ignite a large swath of the economy. So if you're going to be in Europe, you still got to be very selective as a stock picker. I wouldn't make a broad top-down call.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
The next question is from the line of Liz Christian. Please go ahead.
Hey, Matt. It's Liz. I was wondering if you were surprised or intrigued by the access to information during this whole COVID time period. Have you had to rely on existing relationships for communication, or has communication really flowed quite easily?
No, great question, Liz. Good to hear from you. Look, I think that's where our investigative journalists play a big role, you know, on our team. You know, 21 of us, 3 investigative journalists, we pound the phones every day. So, you know, it might sound a little bit funny, too. We're long-term investors. We hold a lot of the same companies over long periods of time. We have relatively low turnover. But we pound the phones a lot, day in, day out, to get a feel of what's going on out there. And to your question, you know, even throughout this crisis, we were uniquely able to reach out very often, very frequently, to double and triple check our own facts, both in terms of the resilience and the pressures near term of some of our businesses and how fast they could or couldn't come back, to know how long of a gap we would have to bridge in terms of liquidity and worst case scenarios. We were able to effectively call into the emerging markets and got a lot of information. And then even here in the U.S., you know, we own some high quality retailers here in the U.S., retailers in the auto parts space. We're able to canvas with our investigative journalists very quickly. And I think that's important because, you know, I mentioned a little earlier, look, it's a 30-second news cycle world. You know, it's hard to distinguish fact from fiction often. I think everybody serves themselves well by always, as Reagan said, trust but verify. We make a lot of phone calls and we try to make sure we can get our own facts. But to your question, you know, I think for most, you know, the easily available facts might have been difficult to get. But for us, with our structure, we've got people particularly dedicated to getting that information, and we get at it pretty effectively.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
The next question is from line of Jack Parker. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you for the call, Matt. Let me ask you, in the global portfolio, where are you finding the best opportunities now?
Yeah, so look, it's a great question, too, and I want to give you a caveat first. We don't allocate top-down in the portfolio, so it won't indicate sort of broad regional allocation swings from a top-down perspective, but it's been actually rather, like buckshot, so to speak. You know, it's in all countries and all sectors, right? So, and that's because we're very agnostic and bottom-up. We were able to buy more in the emerging markets in the downturn. We were able to buy more in Europe, actually probably incrementally on the margin a little bit more in Europe. We were able to buy a little bit more in the U.S. We were able to buy in discretionary. We were able to buy in healthcare. We were able to buy in industrial there we had our eye on. So I'm not a really good source for your questions coming from somebody who's more top-down regionally, oriented with what we do in the global fund. Our global fund, it's like an all-star fund. It's a core product. It's like a set it and forget it, set of best ideas, best quality. It's what hedge funds sort of would charge a 2 and 24. You know, it's that don't use hedge fund at least, or leverage, sorry, at least. You know, it's an absolute collection in concentration, bottom up, the best businesses we can find in the world. It picks only from our regional portfolios, the best of the best compete for each other to get in there. And it all has to do with when you ask what are we getting at there, it has very specifically to do with what individual stocks were down and what we had our eye on. And what we got there more recently were the names we had been wanting to buy for the last several years, for example. And we owned them regionally, and they were undervalued. But at the global level, as we sit with this sort of real higher all-star portfolio, and we're very happy always with what we already own, the standard or hurdle to get in is very high. So we're very, very patient there. And we're able to get at a few that finally cracked in the extreme pessimism of the sell-off. So it's scattershot there, as I said. In the real world, it was a number of real world-class quality brands, you know, in the luxury goods space, like an LVMH in Europe, you know, finally broke down when there was some fear around it there. We finally bought Intuitive Surgical in the U.S. That's a name in the robotic surgery space, which has always been expensive, but it finally cracked, you know, from a long-running sort of 50 times earnings down at its low point around 28, 29 times earnings, which is great for a mid-teens grower for the next couple decades, you know, with 10, 15% of the market cap in cash. So really high quality is what we've gotten at in global. And even another one. Look, we added in global, as Barry asked earlier, we added Adidas in there. We hadn't owned Adidas in global. We own Nike, but Adidas really sold off hard. So it made its way at the same time into emerging and our global portfolios. So it's real specific when it comes to global. Names generally we've had our eye on already for a long time in our regional portfolios that finally get over the hurdle or threshold to offer a particularly extra compelling opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
No other questions at this time?
I will just close it out here, but thank you. Matt, I want to thank you very much for your time today, and I want to thank all of you who have been listening to this call. A replay of the call will be available in the Virtus Voices section of our website. And for additional market commentary and portfolio-specific insights, please visit us at our website at virtus.com. If you have any additional questions or would like further information, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 1-800-243-4361. 1-800-243-4361. Have a safe and pleasant evening. Thanks, everybody. Bye.